This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared, where great minds meet. I'm Head of Programming, Connor Boyle. Coming up, three female writers whose work has focused on what it means to be a woman reaching middle age in a modern society. Victoria Smith is a writer on women's issues and the author of Hags, the Demonization of Middle-Aged Women. The book had quite a reaction when she first appeared on Intelligence Squared last year in 2023 to discuss it with fellow writer Hadley Freeman. So we invited them both back recently in front of a live audience to explore the conversation some more. Joining them on stage at the Tabernacle in London for the event was Sonia Soda, chief leader writer at The Observer and a regular Guardian columnist. There was a lot to say, so this one is coming to you in three parts. If you're an Intelligence Squared member, you can get parts 2 and 3 right now with no waiting around. And part 3 is our members-only bonus, an extended audience Q&A with all three writers. You'll also get all of our special mini-series and ad-free listening too. Head to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up, or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. It's time now to join our host for the evening, Hadley Freeman. She's staff writer at the Sunday Times and author of Good Girls, a story and study of anorexia. Here's Hadley with more.
Hi everyone, thanks so much for coming out this evening. I am so thrilled to be here again for Intelligence Squared to be doing another event with Victoria. Hags is one of those rare books that genuinely changed the conversation, and I'm so thrilled to be here to celebrate the paperback with her. So, as you all, I'm sure, know, Hags, the Demonization of Middle-Aged Women, is a look at why there is so much misogyny coupled with ageism around in the past 5 years, and it really kind of blew up, I would say, over the pandemic. As well as writing a game-changing book, she's a regular contributor to The Critic, where she writes on women's issues, parenting, and mental health. She also writes for The New Statesman, The Independent, and Unheard, and you can also read Victoria regularly in her newsletter, which is at Glosswich. And joining Victoria as my token hag commentator is lovely, very unhaggish Sonia Soda, chief leader writer at The Observer and a Guardian Observer columnist and just all-around brilliant person. So thank you both for joining me today. So Victoria, I'm going to start with the most basic of questions that when I was thinking about, I actually found quite hard to answer, so I think you will find it easier to answer. What is a hag?
I think it was, I have had people sort of say, oh, why did you call it that? Because it's quite a derogatory word, it's quite a harsh word, but it's that kind, but it's also other people kind of, it's a word that I've seen being used in quite a lot of, but you know, there's Sharon Blackie's Hagitude, there's mm-hmm. a short stories book called Hag mm-hmm. as well. And it's that kind of mix of an older woman who is, on the one hand, you could say powerful, but also feared. And it's that kind of mix of...
The witch.
The witch, sort of this kind of ugliness, but also strength. I think I was trying to capture this idea that you have this sort of tranche of women who are being misrepresented, mm-hmm. disliked, told that they need to kind of back away from public life, but actually they have so much to say and so much to contribute and so many experiences as well.
Mm. I mean, the first time I'm quite a slow learner, and the first time I really realized how much people want to hate on middle-aged women, it was during lockdown, and I wrote about the term Karen and how ageist and sexist and weirdly race-based this term was, where it was just mainly about white middle-aged women, and it's just a really quick and easy way to dismiss them. You're such a Karen. And the hate I got from writing about this just astonished me. You addressed the whole Karen thing in the book.
Yeah, and I did feel quite uncomfortable writing about that, because you had this kind of two strands that it was originating from. One as a kind of a shorthand to legitimately criticize racism in white women, but then this other kind of, it started as well on this Reddit thread of a man just criticizing his ex.
His and girlfriend, attack.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's this kind of, and criticizing Karen became particularly tricky, as you'll know from writing the article, because the whole thing about Karen is she complains. So if you complain about Karen, you're a Karen. And I think Sarah Dighton described it, it's a finger trap insult. Yeah. You can't kind of get out of it. And it struck me as it's really dangerous to stigmatize complaining in women, particularly because so often we're taught not to speak out, told to like just tell ourselves we're okay with things, taught not to make a fuss. And I was seeing more and more that the women were, particularly in 2020, when I think, was it The Guardian declared Karen the word of the year? And I'd see, like, you know, I read an article, I think it was about traffic control or something, but the journalist who was female had put, like, I don't want to be a Karen about this.
Gosh.
And then I saw someone on Twitter who complained about a newspaper running an obituary of Peter Sutcliffe being called a Karen for it. And it was just like, it's become like any complaint makes you a Karen. And yep. and yet it's done with this kind of, oh, but it's social justice, because we're actually, this idea that actually we're only attacking these middle-aged women who punch down by attacking poor service staff or attack like people who are really defenceless and marginalized. And actually it wasn't, it was just the idea of complaint.
Well, it was
also
very race-based is kind of what it came to. I mean, Sonia and I talked about this, I remember during lockdown, it was this whole idea that white women endanger black men. Like, if they speak up, then that is a threat. And I mean, it's a safer thing to complain about women than it is to complain about men. But this whole theory that kind of grew up in the wake of George Floyd, that white women are the most dangerous kind of group to people of color, was just astonishing to me.
And it's damaging for all women. Yeah. So I've been called a white feminist because it's actually got nothing to do with your skin color. It's to do with whether you adopt a certain way of unfashionable feminist thinking. So I do think that the term white feminist is used to disparage older, middle-aged women of color who actually dare to think differently and dare to think differently than white men think that women of colour should think. So I think there's definitely something about that. And the other reason why I think it's so damaging is because it establishes this sort of hierarchy of protected characteristics, you know, if you're talking about it from a UK sense, and kind of like race, gender identity, sexuality, they all seem to sort of come higher than the really unfashionable ones, which I think are women and disability. And I do think that it's troubling because it can be very difficult for women from certain ethnic communities to speak out about the behaviour of men in those communities. Mm. And, you know, misogyny is not a race-based trait.
Right.
Brown men are really sexist, black men are really sexist, and white men are really sexist, or some of them are. And there is sexual violence against women right across all these communities. And I actually think sometimes by setting up that hierarchy, you can make it feel like women, actually Asian women or black women, they can't speak out about what goes on in their own communities because they're sort of almost being disloyal. And there's almost a sense created that because Asian men and black men are oppressed because of their race, you shouldn't call out their sexual violence and their violence against women and their misogyny. Mm. And that is so disgusting and wrong, and it harms Asian and black women as well as white women. I feel so strongly about it.
Yeah. And also it became, as the three of us have experienced in terms of talking about gender, a very acceptable way for a certain kind of man to be rabidly misogynistic. So I wrote a piece, I think it was also during lockdown, when I saw that Pixar film Soul, and there's that whole bit in it where there's the Tina Fey character who plays a really annoying soul who I think is going to Earth or something, I can't remember. And the man who's going up to heaven but isn't yet is played by Jamie Foxx, and the soul is Tina Fey. And he says to her, "Why do you have that annoying voice?" And she says, as this amorphous soul, "It's a middle-aged white woman, and it's the most annoying voice there is." And he says, "Yes, you're right." And this is like a Pixar film, like Pixar, Toy Story, for God's sake. And it's just become a really easy way for left-wing men to, first of all, show their bona fides, and also to like beat up, because it's like, oh, privileged, middle-aged white women, like everyone hates them, right?
And I remember reading you'd written about this, and I think you said, like, what many girls in the audience will have mums who are middle-aged white women.
And they will be one day middle-aged white women. Are we saying to them that they shouldn't be women?
Like, but I could really imagine, sort of in how I was when I was younger, that I'd have the impulse, if I saw that, I'd laugh along with it and think, I'm never going to end up like my mum.
Of course. Like, I mean, and both of us have talked about, like, the fear we had about becoming women and becoming like our mothers, and how, for both of us, that played into us developing eating disorders. I mean, this message to young girls to say that being a woman is the naffest, most embarrassing thing you can be is so completely mental.
Yeah. It's like, can you imagine yourself as a middle-aged woman? That won't... I think I kind of had this idea that, like, logically I knew I'd be a middle-aged woman because that's how time works, but it's kind of... But I wouldn't be like them. And I think that's the only reason why I sort of mentioned Edwin Rich quite a lot, because Of Woman Born is a book that really affected me quite deeply, what she writes about matrophobia and this fear of turning into the mother. And when she writes about, you know, I looked at my mother and thought, you know, I'll have kids, and but I'll do it differently. It'll be completely different. And I thought, God, I thought that as well.
Yeah.
And she was thinking that just when I was born. So it's like, God, women have always thought that. And it's really kind, it's so kind of depressing that you're not wanting to form this connection, you're wanting to shoot off in a different direction.
I don't think boys feel that way about their dad. You know, they don't look at them with disgust or just like, I will not be like that when I'm older. Whereas girls are just like, there is a kind of fear of becoming your mother in a way there isn't a fear of becoming your father, I think.
And I think it's kind of endorsed by just all these cultural messages that female aging is taboo. And you know, just like simple things like going, if you go into Boots, the Superdrug, there is so much more product. There's so many more products there to combat female aging than male aging. You know, if you came from outer space, you would obviously think female people have more of a, they must age in a really disturbing way and men don't. But it's just... It's just more taboo for us to even look older.
Mm. And you talk about the three Fs in the book. So what are the three Fs?
So fertility, femininity, and fuckability. And this kind of idea that... It's this idea that the idea of woman is so much shaped by what men want from women.
Well, you know, it's how she's perceived. She's just the object.
And then sort of if a woman sort of... doesn't exemplify these things, if she's aged out of being deemed fertile or fuckable, if she behaves in a way, and I think this is particularly true, I think, in a way that a lot of leftist men respond to outspoken women. If she's not being feminine, then it's just a bit like, what are you even here for? Like, what's your purpose now?
Yeah. It's kind of... Why aren't you listening to me?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know about the two of you, but I've definitely felt that I... felt able to speak up more the older I got. And I don't know if that's because I no longer, I mean, I never thought my face was my fortune, but I no longer felt tied by these notions of how I should be feminine. I mean, I was like, I'm 45 and this is what you get. But the older I get, I've definitely been more aware of this stuff. And also I've definitely been happier about displeasing people and saying things that will make people angry. I just don't care anymore.
It's like a muscle, isn't it? I think once you start using it, you start to realise just quite how irresistible it is. And so, you know, the first time I wrote pieces where, you know, I guess some of my most controversial pieces have been about gender and sex, which all three of us have written about, and also sometimes about race as well. The first time you write something that people on your own side don't like, it's pretty scary, actually.
Yeah.
But after a while, I think you just, A, you get used to it, but B, you're like, actually, I really like exercising my right to say what I think is right. And if you don't like it, tough luck, basically.
Spin. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece, Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents. With the code SQUARED, simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code SQUARED to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
Victoria, do you think that what's changed now is that we're seeing so much misogyny from the progressive side? Or has that always been there and it's just become more obvious as we've gotten older?
I think it's kind of always been there in terms of, as was mentioned in the book, that this idea that some of second wave feminism was prompted by misogyny on the left, mm-hmm. that women were being told to wait their turn and they could, and a woman's place in the revolution is prone, and those mm-hmm. kind of really misogynistic messages. And then, Robin Morgan's like goodbye to all that. Mm-hmm. And also Rich writes about it, this idea that, there's this idea that men are going to have this revolution, but they're not going to lose their privileges. They're still going to they're still going to have as much sex as they want. They're still going to have as many babies as they want. They're still going to get all the goods and services from women that they got before. But somehow, because we'll live in this utopia, women will be just happy to give in the same way, and that they don't have to kind of make those sacrifices. And I think that expectation is quite consistent. But I think, in recent years, maybe partly as kind of a result of online culture yeah. and places like Twitter, men have found slogans and terms to use that enable them to say things about women that they couldn't say before. And it's sometimes it feels like it's been really pent up, like yeah. I've been so good all these years, like I've been really anti, yeah, I'm really anti. I think being pro-abortion rights, I so often see this held up as like, how can I be a misogynist? Yeah. I'm pro-abortion.
I'm such a nice girl.
You know, as if that is just, if I offer you that, like, I'm allowed to say whatever I like. And it, you know, and it's this, but then it's also held as this kind of, particularly in debates on sex and gender, it's almost like, well, you know, if you don't agree with me, you're going to lose your abortion rights.
Yes, right.
But I feel like there are terms, and Karen has obviously been one of them, that suddenly, like, if I use this term, it's not sexism, because I don't mean all women. I'm being progressive.
Yeah.
I just don't like the women who punch down.
And that's what differentiates it from, like, Harridan or Shrew, right?
Yeah.
And it's, like, a very specifically middle-class, middle-aged woman who moans and gets someone in trouble. Is that kind of...
And it's like, I've got teenage sons, and... Yeah, I found one of my sons, he and his friends watched the film A Christmas Carol, which...
A Christmas Carol?
It's a version of A Christmas Carol in which a woman called Karen is visited by the ghost of her former boss, Jackie Marley, and is taught she's got to learn she's been a real Karen, and she's got to learn the errors of her ways.
Wow.
And it's just like, you know, my sons are...
This film sounds awful.
Yeah.
Who's in it?
I don't know. Yeah. Apparently, I was talking to them. Apparently, there are even two versions of it or something.
Wow.
But you know, my sons are white, middle-class boys. And, you know, and I don't think... And it, in a way, the kind of thing they're watching is like... It's like mocking a Shrew or a Harridan in the way they would in kind of 70s or early 80s
yeah,
sitcoms.
Right.
Whereas I'm not sure they would have been as into that, but it's acceptable to kind of...
Well, it's just another version of the mother-in-law joke, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like the annoying, nagging woman. Like nothing's really changed.
Yeah, and I know that when they watch it, it's not out of some great social justice concern. Sorry.
Oh, no. I just wanted to chip in with one thing about kind of the left-wing brand
yes,
of misogyny, because I would agree that it's always been there, and I've written about how sexist I found the Labour Party, for example, mm-hmm. when I worked for the Labour Party in the early 2010s. And I imagine you speak to a woman from any era of the Labour movement, and she'll be able to tell you about misogyny there, and also particularly in the trade unions, I think.
Mm.
But I guess there's a couple of things that I think that has changed in nature. So I think Victoria's absolutely right. I think there's social media. I think the sex and gender debate has given men on the left a license and a label to sort of basically attack women while feeling good about themselves. And then I think the thing about misogyny is it's they're right across the political spectrum, but I think the thing that makes left misogyny quite sort of dangerous in some ways is that because some of these men brand themselves as good people and as saintly people, it kind of makes their misogyny even more pernicious in some ways, because they're like, but we're great, and we're the saints here, and we know the way the world should be, and you're kind of the evil old witches. So I do think that, you know, it's different, I think, the kind of misogyny you see on the political right and the political left, but I don't think the misogyny you see on the political left is any less harmful or damaging.
Oh, yeah.
And in some ways, I think men on the left are, they just believe they're too good to be prejudiced against women, when
yes.
a lot of them are.
I mean, there are those men on the left, like, I'm going to try not to be libelous here, someone like Galloway or Livingston, which is quite old school, hard left, that kind of sexism you saw in trade unions in the 1980s in this country. And then there are men whose names I won't mention, who are so full supporters of the gender issue, to the point that you realize that actually their ideal woman is one with a penis, and that they really do believe that all women should be feminine, because that is basically what the gender movement is saying, is that women should be feminine, and that's why middle-aged women get so beaten up in it, because we do not we do not fit into that mold. And also, we're old enough to know how stupid that is, and also have been through various issues that have been very female-centered, whether it's health or fertility or whatever. But there are certain men who love to have this impunity to shout at middle-aged women, to the point that I wonder if it's like they're shouting at their mother. I mean, that's kind of what it sometimes feels like. I mean, how much for you as a mother of sons do you find that it's kind of like teenage sons rebelling against their mother, dealing with 40-something men online?
Yeah, well, I think sort of the men on Twitter are much worse than my sons, so I love them. I mean, my sons know what my opinions are, because because I express them quite openly.
Yes, right.
But, yeah, to be honest, like one of the things I found, like my oldest son, I'm sure, I think he disagrees with me on the sex and gender debate, and like, and I know a lot of his friends do, but, you know, he's someone who is quite open, so I'm just going to go on about how ace my kids are, but he is someone who is quite open to diverse viewpoints and listening to different viewpoints, but he doesn't spend a lot of time on social media, which I think is good, and I think there is that. There are young men who are really interested in diverse viewpoints. It's the other son who watched the Karens film, but he still loves it. But I do find there is this rage in some men that I just... And it does feel like it's been pent up, and it does feel some of it like... You know, one of the things I felt when I was writing this book was... And it was feeling maybe a little bit of shame at how I'd been when I was younger, this kind of... Because I'd had this idea of feminism as enabling me not to end up like women of my mum's age. Mm. And it's that kind of not quite seeing your mum as a person or seeing her as a person, but thinking that, oh, she does all this stuff because she likes it, kind of like, she likes running around after everyone else. And that kind of, also that kind of thing where, I mean, I've got these very distinct memories when I was younger of kind of male family members mocking female family members
for being
obsessed with cleaning or like, got to be nice about this tea or your mum will go off on one. Yeah. You know, those kind of messages.
Totally. Yeah.
And kind of you're siding with the men and thinking, I'm never going to be a woman who's like treated like that. You know? And it's this kind of like, you kind of cut yourself off. And I sometimes feel like the men who kind of rage at women have never really got beyond, you know, there's a real lack of empathy for... Well, it's a lack of empathy for women in general, and I think, but it manifests itself differently because younger women, it's kind of, they can perceive a use maybe more.
Yeah, and they're more docile and people-pleasing. Like, I certainly was when I was younger.
I was too.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have been terrified of disagreeing with someone like Andrew Neil or whatever. I would have just, like, giggled along or whatever when I was 25 years old. Sorry, Andrew. But, no, I agree. And I also think that it's very telling to see the middle-aged man who I see shouting at you two, and also me, online, how uninterested they are in our experiences, why we think this way about the sexism against middle-aged women, why we think this way about gender activism. Yeah. They just would prefer to write us off as bigoted old hags who've been brainwashed by the right. That I find completely fascinating. Mm. I mean, Sonia, you've had to be writing quite strong leaders on The Observer. Mm. How much reaction do you get from men on the left?
Oh, plenty. I think it's fair to say, although I think it's interesting, because I think it has shifted since I first started writing both leaders and columns on this subject. I mean, it was really extraordinary. Like, I mean, I was shocked by it at first. So, you know, we did a leader at The Observer, I think it would have been about 2.5 years ago now. It was probably the second leader we did on gender and sex issues. The first was on, puberty blockers and the Keira Bell case. But the second was really, there'd been this way of women getting cancelled, and then Jess DeVarles had her art taken away from the shop at, I can't quite
remember. Royal Academy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thank you for helping me out there. So we wrote a leader, which you would think would be really uncontroversial coming from a left liberal newspaper, saying, you know, women have the same right to free expression as everyone else. This is, it's a contested but live political debate. There are multiple competing perspectives. We didn't even say at that point which side of it we were coming down on. And no one really deserves to lose their job over this. And it was honestly the most controversial editorial I've ever written. Like the feedback we got online that, you know, was sent into my editor. I mean, you would have thought that we'd have written some kind of hate manifesto or something. It was just extraordinary. It has changed now, so it's not it doesn't the debate doesn't have that quite that same level of heat, I think, that it did 2.5 years ago, which is a very good thing. So we've made progress, although progress has been slow, and there is still kind of pushback. I think it is a bit more accepted now in political circles, even if not kind of out there in the big wide world in certain institutions where this ideology has taken hold. Mm. I think actually in the world generally people are just like, oh yeah, we agree with you, like, you know, that's what the polling shows. But in politics, I think it has become, people have just been forced to accept this is a debate and no debate isn't sustainable. But yeah, I found it so depressing that writing an editorial saying women, you know, shouldn't lose their jobs for thinking that sex is real, it engendered such a backlash from lefty men and some women as well. It wasn't just men. I mean, it was just extraordinary. Because at least, fine, disagree with their position. Don't think someone's a bigot for holding an entirely rational, legitimate perspective.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I think is so brilliant about Hags is just the timing was so perfect, because there was this double-pronged attack on women who dared to be, you know, dared not to die after 35. Whereas at first it came from the gender rights movement, where it's like, oh, these middle-aged turfs. And then there was the race thing after George Floyd, of these older white women getting black people in trouble. And I have this theory that before that, like if we look back on 2010, 2012, 2013, like we all have seen those shows that look back on how we depicted race in shows like Little Britain or Disability. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, you're kind of shocked at what, you know, actually we were all watching or consuming then. And so, okay, so fine, we can now be careful about that, but we still have to hate someone, so let's make it middle-aged women, it seems to me. I don't know. I mean, you've been looking at more deeply than me, Victoria.
Well, yeah, as I mentioned in the book, like, in Little Britain itself, it had the WI, oh, they stopped being labelled WI after WI complained, but it had two middle-aged women who were, the joke was that they were the bigots. And you had this show in which they were surrounded by, like, men in fat suits and black-faced and being transphobic and being so misogynistic.
I mean, homophobic, which is so weird.
And so much misogyny to do with, like, female bodies as like the jokes about breastfeeding and female incontinence and all these really horrible things. But then in the middle of it, you have like, oh, look, let's now laugh at the bigoted people who are middle-aged women. And it's like, no, it's you, two male comedians.
Yeah.
But it's like, it was already offloading it onto them. And like, you know, and now I think, you know, they've apologised for Little Bit, but I don't think they've specifically apologised for those kind of...
No, of course not.
I don't think they've apologised for the misogyny.
No. And apologised for homophobia and racism or something, because those are the cool prejudices to apologise for. No one needs
but
to apologise.
They're still offloading the idea of bigotry onto middle-aged women, because, like, you know, it's just this ongoing thing that it's them, it's not us.
But is that just kind of displacement thing? Because it is often mothers and older women who call out people like, for example, Russell Brand or Jimmy Savile and all that, while, you know, male TV execs just wave them through, and male interviewers are just going, oh, they're so funny, these guys. And the women in the background going, they're actually disgusting. And then when they are exposed, it's still middle-aged women who are hated.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are sort of older women do perform this kind of, well, they do perform a safeguarding function. They are very aware of these things. I think it can be a mixture of having children themselves and suddenly starting to think about how they protect them, but also maybe thinking about how they were treated when they were younger, when they couldn't speak out. I think Gloria Steinem writes about this, that a lot of older women realised they experienced abuse, that when they were younger they were building up stories around it to say it wasn't abuse, and because that's how you cope. Mm. And then the older woman who actually says, no, this is wrong, and she's really hated, but I think she's kind of expected to be there. I think there is a kind of unspoken reliance on her to perform this social function, but I think she's hated maybe to a great deal at the moment, because it does seem to me that male sexual entitlement has become such a kind of leftist cause.
It's become
like
a protected
putting any kind of limit on it is like being whorephobic, being sexphobic, being frigid. And this has always been there as well. Like Sheila Jeffries, when she wrote about the spinster and her enemies, has said that there's always this failure or maybe deliberate failure to distinguish between right-wing men who are trying to police sexuality in order to control female fertility, yeah, and feminists who are trying to police male sexual entitlement in order to protect women and girls from sexual abuse. And it's like, oh, it's all the same. You're just over there with the Christian fundamentalists. And it's kind of, it's different. And that's become really hard to critique.
Thanks for listening to Intelligence Squared. This episode was produced by Hannah Kay and edited by Tom Hall. Don't forget, there's more of that conversation ready to dive into right now for Intelligence Squared members. You can get part 2 right away and also enjoy the exclusive members only part 3 as well. Just head to intelligencesquared.com/membership to sign up or hit subscribe on Apple for just the audio. I've been Connor Boyle. Thanks for listening.